You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
To Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers and readers meet. And I'm one of the hosts. I'm Bobby Jean and
Jim Bell.
And we want to give a shout out to Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band for the opening music that we just love. It gets our toes tapping. Hot Texas. So, Jim, who do we have with us tonight?
Our featured guest tonight is Claire Fullerton.
Oh.
She hails from Memphis, Tennessee, and now lives in Malibu. She is a multiple award-winning author of 4 traditionally published novels and 1 novella. Her third novel, Morning Dove, is a coming-of-age Southern family saga set in the 1970s, Memphis. Morning Dove is a 13-time award winner, including the literary classic Words on Wings for Book of the Year. Little T is Claire's 4th novel and is set in the Deep South. Little T was a Faulkner Society finalist in the William Wisdom International Competition. And a first place winner in a chance of Claire's Reviews Somerset Award. In addition, she is on staff as a book reviewer with the New York Journal of Books. Please welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, Claire Fullerton.
Oh, we're so happy to have you with us tonight, Claire.
I'm so happy to be here with you. It's been a while at Bobby Jean, hasn't it?
It has. It has. And one of the fun things that we did this afternoon is we went through some of the awards that you've won, and we kind of looked them up because we weren't necessarily familiar with some of these awards or categories. And my first question to you really is, how does an author find where they should enter their works for potential awards?
I think that it's common knowledge. There are a handful of them that all of my fellow friend, contemporary authors, we've known about them for years. You find out about them in literary magazines and journals. You find out about them online, and you find them from your publisher and sometimes through your publicist, you know, who they recommend. I'd say there are probably maybe like 8 of them that really matter.
Yeah. I can understand that. So we're so happy that you're joining us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and when you discovered you were a storyteller?
Oh, what a great, great topic. I love talking about this. I always equate it to keeping a journal from the time I was at a very young age. And I think that that helps to prepare one to be a writer. For one reason, you learn the art of brevity and how to be succinct. And you end up almost editing yourself as you go along. And so from there, I think that it might have been right around 1997 or 98 that I submitted my first short story to an Irish literary journal. And it was about spending time in Ireland. And because it got published and because some of the reader comments said, you know, oh, please write a novel about this. That was how I got my first idea to try my hand at writing a novel. And it was actually my second novel that was published under the title Dancing to an Irish Reel. But it was the first novel I ever wrote. And so I wrote A Portal in Time, which I know that Jim read.
That's right.
I wrote that
right
to,
here.
Yeah, I know. Thank you for that. But I wrote that to get the Irish book published because I figured, you know, if I could just get an open door, then it'd be easier to go through again. And, you know, it's a long process and it takes dedication and commitment and perseverance. And I can't say that it's a daily thing for me, but it's I've been consistent enough with it over the years to produce what I have produced.
Mm-hmm. When you go back and look at your journals, do you see how your writing style has changed?
Or well, first of all, when I go back and look at the journals that I kept in the 1990s, I want to bury them in the backyard. You know, the biggest fear of my life is that anybody would ever find them after my demise. So, yeah, I think that in terms of subject matter, the things that I was concerned with, I find myself, you know, boringly sensitive, you know, which I'm not anymore. I've had that beaten out of me time and age. And it's like, okay, well, that gets you nowhere. So just soldier through. But I think that in terms of all the journals and everything that I've kept going back, probably so, I think that the more that one reads, and by that I mean the really lofty writers, the celebrated ones, the writers that have written the classics, the more one informs their writing through a growth in vocabulary. And I think that I'm one of these people that, you know, not just kind of sort of near what I meant to say, I want to say it precisely and exactly. And so vocabulary has always been a fascination of mine because it's a never-ending pursuit in terms of trying to, you know, command the English language. And you know, I'm well aware that I'm still not there. I think it's a lifelong pursuit, but it, for whatever reason, it interests me passionately. Language, vocabulary, because it's all in the pursuit of communication. And we want to be able to do that as best we can, I think.
When you write, I know, Jim, you've got questions. Should I let you ask a question?
No, go ahead. We're all right. We're ready to go in a minute.
when you write, are you thinking about the reader when you write? Or you're thinking about the characters and kind of what's going on? How do you put all that together?
I approach it as if I were telling a story to one person who understood me already. Now, the reason why I say who understood me already is I don't ever want to insult the reader by over-explaining. I think it's the same instruction that if you've ever taken an acting class, which I have, they say never play to the entire audience because you'll be overwhelmed. Play to one person. And I think that's the same way that I approach writing is there's never any cognizance nor projection in the future as to how many people are going to read it, because that I think puts me in the wrong balance. It needs to be more of a sincere and intimate discourse. And I can say that because to date, I have had the most satisfaction from writing in the first person because I like the intimacy of that as if I were writing to Bobby Jean, as if I were telling Bobby Jean a story. It just keeps it in a narrower perspective for me. And I think if it were anything wider, then I might become self-conscious, which I don't want to do. I mean, one has to have, to a certain degree, a devil-may-care attitude about
it. Yeah. And I do feel that very intimate. I feel when I am in your book, I am in that world, and I am privileged to be in that landscape, be in that dialogue, be in that action, be in that thought-provoking moment that a character is dealing with. And I think that's a rare, I don't feel that in that many books, but when I come to Claire Fullerton, I'm right there.
I just love that so much. Thank you so much.
I know you have a question.
Well, Bobby has several about little T, but starting with little T, I want to ask this kind of a general question. It takes place in the South. So I want to ask a question about what is the South and what is a Southern writer?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah. Thank you, Jim. I think that the South, what is the South, to speak to that first, the most romantic place in America, okay. I think, as a region. And I say that because it still holds fast to its traditions, which are, you know, what anchor the culture to a large degree, and gives the people a certain character. You know, that's interchangeable. I mean, it's the landscape and it's the culture and it's the traditions that make it so specific. And it's really not that big of a region if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And so with regard to what is a Southern writer, I love that question because over the years, I've heard so many different answers to that, and they've all been good, you know, because it's a layered situation, this business of being a Southern writer. I would say that my interpretation of that has to do with the setting of the story being in the South informs the entire context. And by that, I mean the landscape, mm-hmm. the weather, the cicadas in the tree, mm-hmm. the heat. The South tends to have a lot of rivers that run through it. People are the sporting kind, the outdoorsy kind. They hunt and they fish and they, you know, whatever they do, you know, down there. And I think that Southern writers like to celebrate the nuances of the South because they are very specific. It's not the same type of setting that you'd get, say, if you were in Boston, Massachusetts, or anywhere in the, you know, the upper Northeast, so to speak. And it would be different, of course, in the West or mm-hmm. in the Pacific Northwest is specific. And so to be Southern and to be a Southern writer, I think they celebrate the nuances of that region and you know, what sets it apart is well worth, you know, going back to in a body of work, you know, from a Southern writer. Again and again and again, because they want to set the tone and the mood mm-hmm. and the scene. And mm-hmm. and of course, there are subtexts to, you know, the Southern experience. And I have a couple of friends that are really well versed in writing what's known as, you know, Southern Gothic fiction. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. And that, so. You know, it's intentionally strange.
Could you pick a reading? Could you read something for us so that we can hear?
I would. Yeah, I would love to. Yes. Okay. From Little T.
Yes. Little T. Yes.
Okay. I think that, and here's the book cover.
Yes. Cover. Show us the cover. It's so beautiful and engaging and painterly, just like the words of the book.
Well, it just, an aside here, it is to say that when it came time for the cover and I was asked what my vision was, I said, well, I wanted it to be of a house, no people in it whatsoever, but a house so that people could be familiar enough with that house that they would know when they walked from one room into the next, mm-hmm. what was going to be in the next room after that. Mm-hmm. And you do that through repetition, through taking the reader back and back and back again mm-hmm. through the house. Mm-hmm. But I wanted it to be evocative and look like a painting as if somebody had it in pride of place in their home mm-hmm. and which would signify its relevance. And so I wanted it to be weathered and old and quintessentially Southern with the columns and the mm-hmm. verandas in this business. And mm-hmm. so I was quite pleased that Vince Fire Publishing produce this cover. Yes. It was exactly what I was looking for. But mm-hmm. okay, and so from Little T, I'm talking about this house that I've shown you on the cover. Okay, so this is first person narration. And the narrator's name is Celia Wakefield.
Right.
The light was always dim in the entrance hall, irrespective of the time of day. The carved crown molding on its high ceiling matched the dark walnut wood of the floor and door casings, which glowed in polished rosettes above the opening to the formal dining room on the right and the ample living room on the left with the green-tiled solarium behind it. The entrance hall had a central catacomb feel and was always the coolest area of the house in its cavernous elegance. Footsteps were amplified on the maple floors during the months of June through September, then fell to a muted padding when Mom had Thelonious haul the crimson and navy runner from the attic and place it beneath the foyer's round centered table. At the end of the hall, behind the stairs, was my father's den and attendant screened porch, but rarely did I visit the interior. My father was a private man, reclusive and solitary by nature. And whether he was in the library or not, the door was always shut. Mm-hmm. I had to skirt the gladioli arrangement on the entrance hall table. The floral design reached wide with flourishing arms toward the French credenzas against both sides of the wall. My reflection flashed in the Ormond Lumiere as I ran toward the stairs to find my mother. My hair crowned me with the color of night's crescendo, dashing so dark it almost looked purple. I am 100% Wakefield in all that distinguishes the lineage, from the dark eyes and hair to the contrasting fair skin. There has never been a Wakefield to escape the familial nose. It is severe in impression, unambiguous in production, straight as a line and slightly flared.
You give us so much information in such a lyrical, painterly kind of way. The description of her hair, you know, you don't just say, oh, it's dark. It's midnight. What was that? It was
the color, you know, of night's crescendo. And yes, I think how I came up with that, I have no earthly idea. And so, again, I'm speaking back to the magic of thinking that you're speaking to one person, mm-hmm. and vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break there. And we're going to hear a little bit about Tuscany Bay Books. And when we come back, we're going to talk more with Claire Fullerton. Don't touch.
Hey, everybody. Richard Polinelli with Tuscany Bay Books. And if you're a reader looking for the next best adventure for your summertime reading or, you know, coming up on the winter, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and check out our amazing bookshelf filled with books by some of the best authors out there in science fiction, fantasy, mystery thrillers, westerns, you name it. We've got something for you to read. And if you're an author who has just finished your manuscript and you're looking for a publisher, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. Fill out our submission form. We'll take a look at it and we'll see if we can get you published and get you doing what you should be doing, which is writing your very next book. TuscanyBayBooks.com. That's your place to go if you're a reader or a writer. And now back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Tonight's guest is Claire Fullerton, and we'll have a great time talking about her books and the South. We have a question about, what we call these, flashbacks?
Flashbacks. Yeah. It's so interesting that we go, you take us back to the 1980s, and then we're in current time. And we'd love to have you talk a little bit about how that came about and how challenging or not was it to write that way?
That came about by accident. And no, it wasn't challenging because I was winging it through this book. And I started my outline when I was probably a third of the way into it. It occurred to me, maybe I should get an outline. to give this train some train tracks here so we can have a definitive destination. But when I set out to write Little T, it was for one reason. And in truth, I had taken a trip to Memphis, where I grew up. And, you know, when you're reunited with girlfriends that you haven't seen in a long time, and in that instance, I had been reunited with about 12 of them. You know, but I was very aware, almost as if a fly on the wall, of the way that my girlfriends talk to each other. And it just floored me in terms of people, you know, topping each other and adding into, you know, the conversation and just the turns of phrase and just the honesty and that my friends tend to be extremely uncensored and direct. Mm-hmm. And I spent time in Ireland, and they're the opposite. That they're, you know, in the UK or certainly in Ireland, that they tend to be more discreet about everything. They give very little away. But my girlfriends down there are quite a different story. And I remember thinking, if I could just capture the way that women talk amongst each other when there are no men around, because it's quite a different story, that I was just so fascinated in the wisdom and the advice and just the opinions that came forth, you know, while I was down there. And these women are bright and sharp and right on it. And I thought, that's what I want to capture, is the way that the dialogue really is. And I did save you some dialogue.
Okay.
From
good.
Little T, because in preparation you did suggest that, and I found a space.
Good.
But it was that honesty. And I think that the dialogue is very challenging for a writer, because it should not be stilted. And the idea is to make the reader feel as if they're watching a tennis ball volleying back and forth, and they're really privy, you know, to a conversation. And so that's the aim in writing dialogue. But about the flashbacks, that came about quite by accident. And in truth, I was on page 25, and I had established that Celia Wakefield, the narrator, was very hesitant to go down south to see her friend. And yet she did it anyway, in the name of and in the interest of friendship. She felt that it was the right thing to do, but she really was kind of adverse to going. And I had said that. And then on page 25, I said, the reader wants to know why. You've established that she's got baggage. What's the baggage? And so I started the narrator telling about her background. And the idea for Little T took off from there, because I created the character of Thelonia Winfrey, and everybody called her Little T. And so that became its own story. And so I decided to grow the entire what happened by doing alternating time frames in alternating chapters. So it unfolded, and the reader is in current time at a lake with three women that are discussing the longevity of their friendship and life and love and marriage. One of them wants to probably get divorced. She's drinking too much. The other two are trying to sort her out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Celia's telling the story. Mm-hmm. And yet we go back to why she was hesitant to go back down south. What happened? The reader wants to know. And so that was how, once I got a handle on that, then I started making that outline.
Did you ever think about using one of the other women as the first person, or was it just Celia all along?
It was Celia all along, by virtue of the fact that I made that choice going into it. That, you know, somebody had to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And again, I like to write in the first person, because I think it gives the reader something to connect to. I prefer to read those novels that are written in the first person. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of people that feel the exact opposite, but to thine own self be true, right? And
right.
So yeah.
Do you want to read us a little dialogue?
I will. And this requires my glasses again.
That's fine. Well, you can see.
We have those.
I'm still in denial that I have to wear them to read.
Well, we gave up
so
on that.
So am I.
Yeah.
I've had it for 40 years.
All righty. So this is, these chapters have a location heading. And this location is Heber Springs, Arkansas. I was afraid it would happen. I'd been knotted up inside from the moment Tate Foley walked into Rennie's Heber Springs Lake House carrying our history. And all I could think at the time was, thank God we aren't alone. But now Tate wanted to see me by myself, which made me acutely aware that there really can come a point when there's absolutely nothing further to talk about with someone. But what do you do when the past comes back to haunt, as it typically does sooner or later? I think what bothered me most was that I'd unwittingly gone out to meet the past halfway. The irony of my desire to help Ava turning into this reunion with Tate didn't escape me. It confirmed what I'd long suspected, that the only way to move past a hindrance in life is to face it head on. But, oh, I wasn't ready for this. And it was everything I could do not to blame Ava until I realized she was only a convenient article used as a vehicle by fate. Celia, I'm sorry, Ava said with pleading measure. I didn't think it'd be a big deal. Rennie put her cell phone in her pocket. Though she'd been talking to one of her vets at the clinic, she'd heard every word Ava had said. Celia knows that, Rennie said, but that's not the point. You should have asked her, that's all. Celia wasn't standing there with me when I saw Tate this morning. What was I supposed to say? No? If it had been me, I'd have asked Tate for his number and told him I'd give it to Celia, Rennie sounded exasperated. You could have at least put the ball in her court. But they've been friends all their lives. It's not like they're strangers, Ava rationalized. Friends, I rounded on Ava. I believe our history argues otherwise. Well, you were fine when he was here last night. I thought y'all were okay, Ava said. He's just going to call you. What could happen? Rennie jumped in again. Ava, you just told us he wants to take Celia out on the lake. What this means is he wants to see her alone. It puts Celia in an awkward position. What's she going to say? No, Tate. And here's why. Thinking I should referee before it got any bigger, I said, all right, let's drop this. I'll deal with it if and when he calls. But we need to have some kind of understanding among us because we're winging it and failing. How about this? When it comes to Stan or Tate or Mark or anyone else, we should check with the other before we make a move. Is that fair?
Yes, we have three women and we have three men. we have more than three men as the story goes along. Let's take a couple minutes earlier than planned, but let's take another short break. And Sam, if we could have the Out West shop ad. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about these characters from Little T.
Here at the Out West shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. With Claire Fullerton. By the way, we get a coupon special, don't we?
We do. And there's just one word to the coupon.
Radio.
There you go.
You save $10 off an order of $75 or more if you're on our site.
Yep.
We were talking, maybe we could get a little more information about the guys in this story.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Mark and Tate and also Celia's dad.
Oh, well, which one would you like me to start with? I'm happy to talk about all of them.
I'd like to have you talk about Celia's dad.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He is an artist by temperament. He's a little misunderstood. He's a tall, graceful, poetic man with Renaissance hair, and that is, I envision him with it long and black and kind of collar length. And he has doe eyes, it's very fawn-like doe eyes. And he's a gentle man born to landed gentry. And by that, I mean, not necessarily a strata of the aristocracy, but the moneyed people via generations that are land owners. And he's the son of Big John, who's this big, booming, bull in a china shop, overbearing, robust southerner that ran the Wakefield plantation with a very firm hand because it's a working farm. And he has one son, and it's Celia's father. And again, by temperament, he's an artist. So there's a bit of a tug of war going on within him, because he is now inherited, in the time this story goes on, the mantle and the burden that comes with it of, you know, running these 320 acres of cotton and soybean and what they grow on this ancestral property. And so he's a bit of a fish out of water within his own life. And because of that, he's prone to the drink, and he's prone to bouts of depression that will last for, a spiraling week. And his family just kind of doesn't discuss it and walks a little softer, kind of tiptoes around, and nobody really discusses it. And they say, well, you know, if there is an allusion to it, it is, well, you know, Dad's in one of his down days. But other than that, he's a beautiful, subtle man with a lot of heart and soul. He's just been cast in life in the wrong role because his father said so.
You know, speaking of the characters, when we're talking about this film right now, what we kind of ask sometimes, do these characters like have a life of their own sometimes, and they start doing things, you think, whoa, what's happening here?
Do they surprise you?
Never. I am fully and completely and intentionally in control. And I've heard many authors over the years. I mean, and there's so many different ways. And that's what makes, you know, the world go round, so to speak. But yeah, I have heard authors talk about how they're the most surprised when a character says something like this. And I can't relate to that because I got a grip on it.
And we haven't really talked about her. We're sort of moving off the men again, but we really, Little T is named for her. And it feels like this book really is heart and soul. She's an amazing woman, I think. I think all four of the women are really remarkable. And I wish that I had two really good friends from the 70s or the 80s or the 90s that I was still having that same kind of relationship with. I was sort of envious of those women having that such wonderful,
that's an interesting point. Yeah. And you think, what is it that keeps the ties that bind? Because these three women now live in different parts of the country. And you know, are they under the spell of their history, and they feel a certain kind of loyalty, even though their lives have gone in disparate directions, and they really don't have as much in common as they once did. And yet they, you know, adhere to the ties that bind for the sake of adhering to the ties that bind. Mm-hmm. So it's about the history, and it's about the loyalty. And, you know, you get that way in life that I think most of us can say, in some areas we've outgrown those really good girlfriends that, you know, we had in high school, and yet we still keep in touch. Mm-hmm. You may not have a lot in common, you know? So it's the history and it's the loyalty that is, you know, makes the whole thing unambiguous, you know? And so that was sort of part of what was going on with the three friends at the lake house. And with Little T, thank you for saying you found her a strong character. I think that she had to be, because she, you know, she was Black and her best friend was white, and they were all living on this vast acreage, the grounds that the Wakefields owned. And for Little T, whose real name is Thelonia, and for Celia to be best friends, because they grew up together, and they were both in their own little universe on the grounds of that the Wakefields owned. And you know how you're footloose and fancy free before you can drive, and there's woods all around you, and you find things to do in the woods, and you can be creative, and you know, so to have somebody with you that's willing to play along in your fantasy world, well, that's going to leave a profound bind, I think. And so with Little T and with Celia being best friends and it being the early part of the 1980s, mm-hmm. you know, there was the question of that I intentionally wanted to pose. What will people think? Mm-hmm. Because of the times and because of the regions. And I actually picked up the phone and called a few friends. And one happens to be a woman who is also a writer, and she's in her 80s at the moment. And I called her and I said, just refresh my memory, because I've been living in California for a long time. But in the early 1980s, was there still a little bit of that divide culturally between the races? And all confirmed that, oh, yes, there definitely was. And so once I really committed to that, then I made that part of the story bigger mm-hmm. because it was accurate.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to believe. I mean, here we are in 2022. So the 80s are, 42 years ago.
But, the heck about quickly.
Well, yeah, but it feels like it is history, but it still feels very contemporary, because most all readers, well, you would have to be obviously have been born after 1980, but right, you know, for so many of what I would imagine as your reading audience, we were there and we were old enough to have memory of it. You know, we weren't 5 years old. We were, adults.
Maybe, and it wasn't that long ago to us.
So it was interesting that you had said it in 1980, and then we kind of realize, oh yeah, that actually is a while ago. But I have memory of that, time period in our own lives,
Exactly.
So that was very interesting to me. Let's see. I'm looking at time. So Sam, why don't are we back? And we're back. So much for the live techno. We are live. Claire, we'll just go on right here. Let's see. We would love to talk to you. We have talked a bit about creative processes. We've been chatting, but I would love to know, where are your dogs when you are writing?
You have dogs?
Yes, I do. I have 3 mature, full-grown German shepherds, and they're smarter than I am. And right now, I think they are upstairs with my husband keeping out of the way. But I have a friend named Kathleen Rogers, yes. who is an author, and I believe you've had her on the show. Mm-hmm. And she has a few books out, and we keep in touch. And I was just going back and forth with her, but before airtime, and saying it's the dog hour. And what I mean by that is that we have a schedule, like it's really a rut, but it's a schedule that we're in.
Yeah.
About an hour and a half before the sun sets out here, we are out on the property running the dogs, throwing the ball. They find pine cones. They chase rabbits. They have a blast. And if it's 5 minutes after their schedule, they let us know. They are pushy. And, if you've ever had a German Shepherd, or are you familiar with the breed, that their job is to shepherd you. And so wherever you go, they are on your ankle. you know, and it doesn't matter where you go. But so I am quite used to having, you know, three dog noses attached to me with pretty much every step I take inside and outside, as long as I'm on this property. Mm-hmm. So thank you for asking about the dogs.
Oh yes. Cause you do post wonderful photos of them. And so it's very fun.
So on the heels of this, then where do you write and where do you find time to write?
I write in my own room, and it's set up with a cherry wood sleigh bed. It's like a day bed, you know, it's the size of a twin and the foot and the heading the same height. And so there's that. And then I have a 6 shelved bookcase here with a lot of my crystals on it, which I collect quartz and amethyst and I have forever. Interspersed with that and my favorite books that I want on display. And I do have a desk, and it does not face the ocean intentionally. Mm-hmm. My back is to the ocean.
Your back is to the ocean.
But it is, a full-size sliding glass door that can take me from the room I'm in to the front yard. And so it's that way. And so it's not a big room, but what it is very efficient. And it has lots of closet space as well. And I have things on the wall from Ireland and an antique mirror and my grandmother and her two sisters and, you know, a big photograph of my grandmother on her wedding day, a profile view that's exquisite. You know, it's very old and in an oval frame and that sentimental value. And so things that mean a lot to me are around me. And I think that for many, many years, to your question, I really wrote pretty much to a large degree all day, every day, you know, with the odd break that was, I would begin a project and see it through until it was finished. And, you know, I can say that Morning Dove and Little Tea came out pretty much back to back, that it was 18 months after Morning Dove, maybe a little bit more that Little Tea came out. And so if you add the promotion to that, the writing and then the attendant promotion that it takes, it really felt like I was in this big wheel of really, you know, my life focus being on that. And I do have a fifth manuscript that's completed and we will see if it finds a home, but at the moment, and really for the first time in years, I am actually sort of doing other things other than just focused on writing all day, every day and being, you know, responsible for promoting it. And, you know, I can't say how long that this is going to go, but I'm enjoying it now because I kind of feel like, oh, so this is what life is like beyond the desk. You know?
Go ahead, Jim.
I would say we need to ask about this new project.
She may not want to tell us
anything. I'm going to keep that.
She's going to keep it a secret.
I'm going to keep it completely under wraps.
Okay.
And let you know if and when it's going to see the light of day. Sitting here right now, I have no idea.
What's the best writing advice you've ever been given?
I've never been given advice, you know, writing advice, and I'm not sure if I were given it that I would take it. Mm-hmm. That's not my personality, you know. I tend to find my own way through all things, you know. People's well-meaning advice, notwithstanding. It could be a character defect of mine, but yeah, I tend to sort of be in my own rhythm with all things. Mm-hmm. But I think that I certainly appreciate and have always been interested in a lot of, for instance, what Pat Conroy had to say about his writing process, the insights that he would wittingly or unwittingly share about. For instance, I'll give you a good example. He was writing an essay about being in Italy, and he was taking a walk, and he used the line that he was walking along, and he was writing in his head. Mm-hmm. And when I read that line, and that's all he said. He didn't belabor it. He didn't anything. You know, he just carried on. But I thought, you too, because yeah. You know, and I think that that's common. That, you know, as let's say you're in a new environment, or you see something that is awe-inspiring, you know, you tend to in your head start putting it into words. And I think that's what he meant by that line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a very special program coming up that you're offering through the Catholic Arts Literacy Group. Why don't you tell us about that?
Thank you so much for asking. Now, I really appreciate that, Bobby. Thank you. It is going to be fun. And the reason why I say this is when a Portal in Time was published in 2013, I believe.
I think so.
Long time. And I came to you when it did. That's how, Bobby, that's how you and I started our love fest.
Yes.
Was that book. But I think that, and I came down and didn't get in y'all's elevator. At LA, remember that? I wouldn't get in that elevator. No.
I forgot that. Okay, yes, I didn't. I remember that now.
But yeah, so with the Catholic Literary Arts, I have a wonderful opportunity to do what I wish that somebody would have done for me when A Portal in Time was released, because it was this fear of, what do I do? What am I supposed to be doing? Where do I go? How am I supposed to promote this book? And typically your publisher will give you a lot of pretty stereotypical guideposts, but rarely do they know what the writer eventually discovers, which is the process of promotion is a big web, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger as you go along. And the wise person has a strategy going into it, and they're going to line up 6 months out who they're going to approach for reviews, for blog spots, for Instagram, this and that. Today we have, you know, podcasts are prevalent and all these things. And so it's about promoting a book, and specifically launching a book. So preparing to get your book out in the world. I'm going to give a class. It'll be on the 27th of this month, which is a Tuesday, and it's 7:00 Central Time. And it's going to be me talking to everybody. I'm not going to come up there with, you know, bullet points on a screen. I'm going to say, get a pencil and a notebook and write this down, because I'm going to tell you what I know in terms mm-hmm. of how to prepare to launch a book. And so the Catholic Literary Arts is dedicated to furthering the literary arts, and they have guest instructors, you know, come on. And what the attendees do is register for the class, and you can do it online at CatholicLiteraryArts.org. I have a graphic at the moment on my Facebook profile page. You'll see a picture of yours truly, and it has a link there about this event, and it mentions you with a lot of love and a lot of appreciation. And
wonderful.
And so that is up there. But the CatholicLiteraryArts.org, and you can register for the class. And again, the 27th, 7:00 Central. It's a Tuesday evening. And I'm very excited to be able to sort of demystify what feel overwhelming. So yeah.
Claire, I'm looking at that clock and the countdown, and I'm going to say thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's so delightful. We have parting advice for authors tonight, and it's from William Faulkner. And he says, don't be a writer, be writing. On behalf of Jim and me, till we meet again next week, remember, it's always a great day out west. Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Claire.
Thank you.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.